Here we have Su Veer, who is a EFT founding master, an international trainer, presenter, writer, and has also a busy practice in London, so probably she doesn't need your help with this. She's the author of Healing the Addicted Heart in 5 Stages and the co-founder of EFT Center. Welcome, Su.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Florence. This is my inner rock star that never actually came to manifestation. So maybe I'll apply some of Benny's work to it and see where that goes. So what I'm going to be talking to you today about is uncovering the roots of addiction. And what I have done recently is kind of revisit my own book, which is Healing the Addicted Heart, 5 Stages of Transformation. And it's a kind of curious book because I actually go back and read it as if I'd never come across it before. It might seem rather weird, but Emma and I were doing a workshop in Brussels on healing the addicted heart. It was a 3-day workshop. And in the evenings, I would actually sit and read my own book and thought, oh, that's interesting. Yes, okay, well, I think maybe we'll tweak that. It didn't occur to me at first that this was actually weird. What is it about this? And what I came to realise actually links in nicely with what Benny was saying, is that I know much more than I know that I know. And this is really the theme of my talk today, that we all of us know exactly what we need. We have the solutions that we need. And I don't mean that in the superficial sense that you've learned it before at a workshop. I mean it in a much deeper sense. I mean it in an existential sense, that when we come into the world, we kind of come into the world with a split in our minds. And it's the mind which is driving us, and the body, really, you know, we rock around and go to workshops and tap on and all that kind of thing, is really kind of like the broadcasting facility, like a radio that's being informed by mind. And mind is split, and it's split in a way that works for us and works against us. So while I've been revisiting my own book, very interesting book, I highly recommend it. on our website, so I'll give you the details of that later. So while I've been revisiting my book, I've been looking at some of the ideas around trauma and how that shows up in our experience. And some of the ideas that I do explain in the book, but I've actually kind of come to understand more about in the 2 years since the book came out. So what I've kind of realised is that the beginning point is that this split in the mind, which I describe as being, you know, either love or fear, and the idea that fear is this state of mind that we actually mostly all identify with most of the time. And it's highly complex and can have all manner of manifestations. You know, whether it's what we're talking about today, like, you know, what are your limiting beliefs? You know, how much money do you want to earn? What's stopping you from earning that? That's a manifestation of fear mind. You know, all of that kind of to and froing about what's working for us, what's not working for us. It's also the myriad possibilities that we can have for different types of anxiety, stress, pain, physical issues, addictions, you know, which we're actually going to come to directly in a moment. And then the state of love is that it's accessing that part of mind when none of that exists. It simply doesn't matter. And in fact, we all have access to either of these aspects of mind at all time, but only one is real. Now, the problem is actually that we totally identify with the part of the mind that isn't real. So we're kind of all going around, you know, endlessly searching for solutions to our problems. And we're finding temporary solutions to our problems. But then we just kind of create more of the same thing. So until we understand that actually and where we have more joy, we have more happiness. The idea of, you know, manifesting successful work, manifesting all the money that we possibly want, that's easy peasy from that state of mind. And then the other big part of the problem is that we all collude with each other in kind of, you know, living in fear and living from this part of the mind where nothing's going to work. And it's never going to work. You know, that's the big news. Like, you know, Ben was saying, you suddenly got it about the money thing. You know, I kind of got it that nothing that you do is going to work until you begin to really realize that you have access to a part of your mind that knows more about you than you do. So that's really what this is going to be about. I'll just tell you a few things that have kind of, you know, informed where I've come to now after 2 years since writing the book. I've kind of realized with hindsight. And by the way, while I'm talking to you, I'm just thinking, isn't it amazing to come back after 2 years to something that I did, that I produced, that I created, and then realize that there's more to it. I love that idea. You know, if I didn't just park that and go, oh, you know, that's me dying. You know, it's growing, it's organic, you know, as I am, and as I'm able to share with you today. So looking back 2 years, I remember that there was a story about the heart, which, actually, it's not a story, it's a memory, really, that I wanted to include in the book, and I didn't, because I couldn't kind of work out why I was interested in this story, why it kept popping up in my mind. And I do understand why now, and it fits in with what I'm going to be talking about. And the memory was of being at school in a biology lesson, and that in itself was quite extraordinary, because I don't remember anything else whatsoever about biology, but apart from kind of sitting at the back and being a troublemaker, I think, and you know, that being fun, but in actual terms of, you know, biology, I don't remember anything apart from this one day when we were doing, what's it called when you cut things?
Dissection.
Dissection, yeah, that's it. So we had a rodent, and we were extracting a heart cell from the rodent. And I might not get the terminology right in this, because as I said, I don't really remember anything about what I was supposed to be doing, but it's just this kind of metaphor, I think, that came from it. So we extracted one heart cell from the rodent and put it on a slide. And then the idea was that we would see what happened, because if it's still living, when you extract a heart cell, you put it in something, it's called in vivo or something like that, so you put it on this slide. Sorry, scientists, I'm really probably quite good. Put it on the slide. and it's still alive. And you can see it's still alive, because it's fibrillating, it's still beating. You can see it. No, actually, that's not true. It's still alive. But it starts to go towards the point of death, and it goes into the spasmodic kind of beating, which I think is called fibrillation, and then it dies, because, you know, obviously it can't exist outside the rat, or the rat is on there anyway. So this is it. So you see one cell, and then it goes. But the really interesting thing was that we then did this thing where you got two cells, so two heart cells, and put them on the slide. And if you move them to a certain point of this sort of magical proximity, something different happened. And what they would do is that they would both start fibrillating, doing sort of spasmodic, out of kilter with each other, lurching all over the place. And then at this magical point of proximity, they would actually synchronize and form a new unit, even though they weren't physically connected. In fact, you could even put something down the gap to sort of physically separate them. And so this, of course, as we understand now, is an energetic connection that is going on here. So the cells themselves have this kind of innate drive to become coherent, to become whole, to become unified. And so what happens is that this magical, they do that, and then they're like a little mini heart that will just go on instead of dying, which is what happens when they're separate with one cell and this idea of separation. So this story kind of stuck in my head, and I just couldn't find a place to put it. But what I've realized now is this is the whole point of everything. It's the idea of the separation, which is the problem, which is really the fear state, fear mind that we're connected to, and love, which is really the state of wholeness, coherence, coming together, unity. And we have this innate drive within ourselves for this to happen. So this really doesn't have to do with kind of, you know, studying things, going to workshops, learning fascinating things about tapping. It's already there inside. So something has gone wrong in our kind of physical experience for us to be sharing, including in this state of fear. And we all have that experience. That's a kind of collective experience. I don't think any of us have ever met anybody that was completely congruently happy and successful and loving all the time. Have we? My dog. I do make the exception on dogs. Okay, but yeah, and when we're talking about human beings, we have a lot to learn from dogs. I mean, yes. Absolutely, that is true. You know, we're just not kind of happy, whole, complete. And sometimes, you know, we'll kind of see it written in, you know, spiritual type literature that if we really were happy, whole, and complete, we wouldn't be here. We'd have vibrated off the planet and vibrated off the earth and manifested in a different form. And be, you know, be in spirit. And I guess that maybe that's true. I don't know, because I happen to be here in this physical body. You know, I actually don't know about that. It's a good idea. I like the idea. And I have a sense that I probably know that it's true. But, you know, whatever. I still have to manage being sitting here at this moment on this stage and doing various things and hopefully writing, you know, a few books more and that kind of thing. So the point is that we know a hell of a lot more than we know that we know. And something has gone wrong. Why are we attempting to become whole again, to complete ourselves, unless something has gone wrong? That we've lost something, or we've somehow lost our way. We only need to go home when we're not at home. And I think that many, many people will know that kind of sense of not being quite at home as we are at this point. At this right now, there's always something that we want more of, there's always something that could be better, there's always some problem that we could get over. So this brings me back to the idea of addictions, and this is a theme in my book, that addictions are not just about substances. They're like heroin, like crystal meth, like smoking, like alcohol. I believe that all problems are addictions. That in actual fact, any kind of problem is a manifestation of fear mind. That we've lost our way and we've got kind of caught in that whole mass of area that could go on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Forever, trying to find a way to make the problem better, but it's like we're approaching it from completely the wrong way, looking in the wrong place. And unless we change our minds, unless we understand how minds are kind of operating to manifest problems, we're not really going to be able to get over them. You know, it's a bit like, you know, a good analogy is projecting a film on the screen, and if you think of the film projector as being mind, and so it's projecting the film to see on the screen. Now, if you're really in cinema, you might get very engaged in the film, but you don't think that's real, do you? You kind of know that that's the film that's being projected from the projector. But what we're really trying to do with our problems is it's like the equivalent that we're rushing up the screen and shouting at that nasty bloke who's about to rob the bank. On the screen, go, no, stop that, that's all wrong, you know, that's going to cause another problem. You know, whereas actually, what we have to do is change what's happening in the projection booth. We've got to change the mind that's creating what we see out here, what we experience out here. And this has become, it's become become so clear to me that I have to ask you back up, you know, what Betty was saying. Don't keep going to therapists, don't keep going to workshops, you don't keep reading books. You've got to get it on the inside because it's already there. It's absolutely already there. Okay, so next thing, let's look at it from the perspective of trauma. Part of this presentation today is about dissolving the relationship between trauma and addictions. Now, in my book, I talk about the traumatized self in using a slightly different terminology. I talk about the traumatized self as being the addictive heart. So this leads us to the heart actually knowing the way out of all our problems. So when we're in the state of not knowing the way out, that's what I'm really referring to as the addictive heart. And 2 years ago, I thought that the relationship really between the addicted heart and trauma was that through the experience of trauma, whether it's little traumas, you know, the kind of things that happens to everybody at school and get rejected by friends, you know, we get kind of frustrated when we're not allowed to do something. As a 7-year-old child, you know, you're not allowed to go out and play when other people are going out to play. Now that can register for trauma. You know, the way that maybe mum or aunt or dad has probably dealt with that is they used a harsh tone or they looked at us in a particular way. That can register as trauma in our systems. You know? I have no doubt about that at all. And of course, there's also the experience of trauma on the big giant scale, where you know we may have been involved in a rape or murder or accident, firing, one of the shared huge traumas, you know, like 9/11 or 7/7 as we had in the UK. So they are the kind of things that we would talk about as being trauma, and they're the kind of things that most people would sort of agree, oh yes, that's trauma, whilst forgetting that there's so much that goes on at a kind of much apparently lower key level that really forms this fundamental kind of shutting down of the self. So I'll talk about a little bit more of that in a moment. And that's kind of what I mean by the addicted heart, is where through the process of trauma, we've really kind of lost our connection to our strength. So now what I really get is that there's also the one fundamental shared trauma, and that is, I think, is what we come into the world with, the idea that we are not at home here. So I think there's the one trauma that fits in with the one belief that I think we all have that produces addictions is that we're separate. You know, it's a terrifying notion that we are separate and alone, and therefore we need to make ourselves feel better. So how this links up with the idea of trauma is that if we come into the world with that idea that somehow or other, that we don't know, we don't consciously know this, but we have a sense that we're not at home here, that's hugely traumatic. And so anything that does happen to us after that point is kind of bouncing off that one original trauma. Does this kind of make sense? I started sort of thinking more about this stuff in working with clients, really, because a lot of times, if I was asking a client something like, you know, remembering a time when you did feel good and whole and complete, how very, very many people really couldn't find anything at all in their experience. And so you said, well, you know, go back, you know, imagine what it was like as a newborn baby and, you know, a state of innocence and joy and happiness. And I go, well, no, because I didn't want to come into the world. I didn't want to be here. I can remember that. I remember that when I was in the womb. And I didn't want to come into the world. And, you know, my mother didn't want me to come into the world. And, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It's very common. How So I don't think it's the case that we come into the world as babies and everything's perfect and then stuff happens to us and then it all goes pear-shaped. No. I think coming into the world pear-shaped because we're not really, really meant to be having this physical experience. Other than that, it's the way that we find our way out. That's kind of the point, I think. So we are meant to be having this physical experience, and what we have to see through is the illusion that it's actually real. That anything can really happen to us that can harm our fundamental truth that we are okay. And that's the whole point. And when you get that in your head, you're only realizing something that you already know. Okay? So what it amounts to really is sort of the loss of our sense of our own divinity is terribly painful. And if that happens in the context of trauma, or that we kind of get reminded of that in the context of trauma, you know, it sets up a whole kind of process that is actually very difficult to undo if you're trying to undo it from believing that it's all real. Because what happens, we know quite a lot now about the whole kind of mechanism of trauma. That, you know, something happens to us and we're not able to fully process at the time. As Andrea was talking about it, you know, this is everyone's story, absolutely everyone's story. We're just not able to fully process the things that do happen to us. Some people can deal with great good things, other people will be traumatized by tiny things, meekness. Actually, just I didn't have a big trauma type background, because I don't know, I've never survived, you know. My experience was traumatic enough just from looks on people's faces and, you know, kind of sort of normally dysfunctional type of, you know, upbringing and family. But what happens is that when we get to the point of being kind of frozen in trauma, which is our natural kind of physiological response, we make some kind of decision about ourselves at that point. And actually, we all know this through working with EFT. You know, you will have found that from the sort of inside, because you have had that experience yourself, or you have had clients kind of report that to you. That's kind of the point, that when something happens, in the split second of us sort of freezing, which is our physiological way of actually staying alive in that moment, we will decide something like, I'm not good enough, I'm not lovable, I'm all alone, I'm abandoned. And the problem is, it gets fused with the fact that we survived. Does that make sense? So it's kind of a positive thing. And that's, you know, herein lies the danger, really. Because this is all like immediately kind of, you know, put away into the unconscious mind. So, you know, we're not sitting there, you know, every day kind of evaluating the decision I made about myself when I was five. And, you know, is that positive or is that negative? But at the sort of in the kind of the deeper levels of the mind, deciding something like I'm not lovable, and that being equated with surviving in a perilous, awful situation, means that we then need another layer of kind of protection around that, where it's like we're sort of saying inside ourselves, I got away with that. That they don't know that I'm not lovable. That they don't know that I'm bad. They don't know that I did something wrong. And as long as I keep really quiet about that, no one will know. This is shame. This is John Bradshaw's book, The Shame That Binds Us. This is what kind of keeps us in the problem. And this is exactly what happens with clients who will go to therapists, even EFT practitioners, tell you not say what is actually the problem. They won't say what they really feel about themselves. That's shame. You have to keep that quiet, because we've got this fusion, like literal fusion, the belief that appears to save us, and the fact that we maybe did survive in a life or death situation. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about being, you know, somebody looking at us, the mini trait form of somebody looking at us in a way that, well, loving. To a child, that is a life or death. Like in a moment of time, we're sort of disconnected from somebody important to us. And we experience that as being like death. You know, this is why it's so tricky growing up, because, you know, all of this is really difficult to navigate through. You can't really do it successfully. You have to go back and do it. So, you know, which is great that we're able to do that with the tools and techniques that we've got now. So, here we have, you know, we have shame. We can't let on what has really happened. So, quite apart from not letting on what has really happened to anybody else or the therapist or whatever, oftentimes we don't let on to ourselves. We don't really know. So that's, you know, that's often what's out of our conscious awareness. And that's what's driving all of our kind of problem behaviours, whether they show up as an addiction, you know, which is alcohol or smoking or whatever. Because when we're in that state of shame, you know, protecting ourselves from our survival, I must never let anyone know how bad I am, we've completely lost our connection to our truth. We're completely on the fear side of the polarized mind. And that is a terrible state for us to experience. And inside ourselves, we know that. So we've got this enormous conflict going on between the false self that's created, which is really the addictive part, and the part of us that knows that really knows that there's something else. And that creates a sort of unbearable tension. So we have to do something about it. We have to have some form of problem. You know, and really, depending on how easy you are to appease, you know, how easy your psyche is to appease, you might be able to get away with, you know, having, you know, an attachment to doing a lot of texting or watching a lot of television, you know, these so-called sort of minor sort of habitual behaviors. If you need quite a lot more tranquilizing, you might go for a full-blown alcohol addiction or heroin or something like that. And quite often, you know, with substance abuse, we will go for things that sort of mimic the state of being connected to ourselves, of being at peace. You know, drugs like ecstasy and LSD, which kind of give you a real sense of divinity. You know, often love, connection. We don't go for those kind of things for no reason. We go for them because we're substituted for what we think that we've lost inside, but actually we haven't really lost inside. So I've just had the 15-minute card. So let's switch to the solution. And actually, the solution isn't something that you have to do. The solution is kind of in the form, it's in thought forms that are already in each of our minds. When I was writing my book, I outlined what I thought of as sort of five premises that seemed to me to kind of be premises upon which our mind would enable us to be completely free of whatever addictive state is, you know, we've been grappling with or struggling with. And now, when I think about now, I think they kind of keys that, not just the observations that I've made before, I think they're actually keys that when we kind of realise that we each of us have these keys in our own minds, we don't have to do so much tapping, for instance. You know, in the future, we've got to get ourselves straight on this, actually. Otherwise, people will just be tapped to death, and they'll still go around having more problems, and, you know, they'll get wrong, something else will pop up, and they'll jump. So we have to get straight on how, you know, the unconscious mind is working. And what I've observed since writing the book is that if I'm clear about these premises or keys, that transmits, a bit like the heart cell does, to another person, that actually I don't have to consciously tell the other person if I'm, you know, working with somebody else, or even if I'm just being with somebody knowing about and congruity about it, transmit, because they already know, because we've already got it. So it's like we've all got both the trauma of not being at home here, which is fear, mine, and we've all got the keys that are really in our heart. That's the link really between the two states. So I started to realise that the heart quite literally is the kind of the seat of our knowing much more about ourselves than we think that we do. So the first premise really, or key, is the idea that everything comes from thought, which is, you know, this is really what I've been saying throughout this entire presentation, that everything comes from thought. So all behaviours, all problems, all manifestations of anything in physicality comes from thought, as in the sense of from mind, unconscious mind. It goes way beyond the, you know, kind of personal individual experience that we have processed by the brain. Okay, so to kind of get this, it's the idea that mind is all around, except it's not really all around, because we're not really around to be around of. But in another way, it's more like we're the radio that's being played by mind. And until we're kind of conscious of how we can align ourselves one way or the other, with fear or love, it plays out as fear. That's just how it goes. So, first thing is that absolutely everything comes from thought. So, mind expresses itself through us in everything that we do, in our language and in our behavior. The second key is that addictions, and I'm now substituting that any problem that we experience, are just attempts at a solution. They're attempts at the solution to the existential pain that we all come into the world with, I believe, and therefore they're substitutes for what we really want, or actually really have, which is love. And we're actually looking in the wrong place for that because we already have it. So, you know, there's all this kind of distraction of trying to solve problems. We already have what we're actually looking for. So that means, really, that we can then sort of treat whatever the problem is, you know, whether it's addiction or some other description of the problem, as an alternative, the solution, and the substitute for what we really want. So it's shifting the whole kind of, it's shifting the whole validity that we give to problem states. When we're connecting from fear mind, go in with the belief that it's true. You go in to dealing with problems as if it's just a mistaken setup. It's a whole different ballgame. It can't withstand your knowing. So you just tackle on this. That's what I'm really quite keen to say. You know, that we don't need more techniques. We don't need more tackling. We need to change our minds about what we think our problems mean and how we think that they're constructed. We have total charge, total power over every manifestation that comes through. So, addictions are substitutions. Third premise, you can change your mind at any point. You can change your mind at any point. So change can happen in a nanosecond. So it's completely not the case that you've had a problem for 15 years and you've had a very traumatic background. It's going to take 15 years to solve it, and it'd be really much more difficult than Joe Locks down the street who never had any, you know, had brilliant parents and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's all to do with how you're thinking about the problem yourself. So anything you can just go like that, including physical disease. You know, there's billions of, well, not billions, but there are many reports of total remission from, you know, terminal cancer cases. And the medics sort of report it as unexplained. Well, it's not unexplained. It's explained because that person changed their mind at the deepest level, the fundamental level, and their body just followed. Maybe overnight. You know, there are documented cases of people literally kind of changing in a matter of hours or days or whatever. So you can change your mind at any point. The key is to keep realigning yourself with that change in your mind. You know, it's not a once and for all thing. We have to keep realigning ourselves. Otherwise, because we're always, this is, in a way, this is free will. We can always go that way or that way. So change can happen in a nanosecond, but we have to keep kind of realigning ourselves. And the fourth premise, I've completely forgotten. The fourth point is do nothing.
That's what I think.
Yes, I like it. It's do nothing, and you don't need to do anything. I mean, it doesn't mean you don't ever get out of bed, you know, don't be nice. It doesn't mean that, but it means get out of your own way, and you will be kind of informed about what you need to do and how to go about it. And then the fifth premise is that we can only know ourselves in relationship. So that is, this is back to the heart cells really, and we're coming together as the heart cells. We can only really become whole by realizing that every single person out there is playing out an aspect of ourselves, which puts a whole different spin on it. Because you can spend ages being really, really angry with your boss and doing months of tapping on it, and then you go off and you find another boss that you get really angry with, and you can do a whole load of tapping on that boss as well. That boss is you, but. I mean, like, literally you, it's literally, like, you know, if you think of it as being sort of cells coming together, you're not at the magical state of proximity where you kind of reclaim that part of yourself and then become whole again. So this is a whole subject of forgiveness, which, on the Healing Addicted Heart workshop and Open to Love workshop is a big part of what we do. So forgiveness is not letting somebody off. It's actually reclaiming their energy back into yourself, because you're just acting out some part of your own unhealedness out there. So only in relationship can we know ourselves in the deepest sense. So that's to do with everything. It's our relationship with absolutely everything. You know, with the world at large, with the earth, with the way we treat the news agent when we go out, on Earth. You know, any kind of just trip down the street, the way we walk on pavements, our relationship to absolutely everything. Because somehow we have become split apart into billions of pieces. And our job is to, like the heart cells, to allow that process of coming together again. And I do think, I know I'm being a bit naughty and saying, less tapping, stop tapping, and don't go to workshops. I am being a little bit ironic and tongue-in-cheek there, because I do think that we guys that have taken these techniques and the tapping and the different ways that are complementary to it are kind of ahead of the game. It's like we have somehow understood something that others will follow, I think. And what I'm saying today, even 2 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to say, because I wouldn't have understood it. And I don't think it would have been heard in the same way. So, we're going really fast, because it's like, the heart and love for truth. It's just waiting for the opportunity. It's just waiting for the invitation.
We're on the leading edge.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's it, really.